Morris Communications sells its local newspapers to a new owner. What that means for readers and employees just ahead. Good Thursday morning and live from Studio 5. This is First Coast Connect on 89.9. Thanks for listening. I'm Melissa Ross, and we are always live at 9. Also, never miss a show. Download the WJCT app. Listen to us there anytime. You can also stream us live on Facebook right now. Just ahead, big news in the media world as Morris gets out of the newspaper business, selling 11 of its publications, including the Florida Times Union and the St. Augustine Record. Just ahead, a look at what impact that sale might have here on the First Coast. Give us a call now with your thoughts at 549-2937. Then later, a look at the president's proposal to privatize the nation's air traffic controllers. We'll tell you why there's opposition to that and spotlighting the latest production from Jacksonville's own Five and Dime Theater. All of that and more ahead. But first this hour, bombshell news in the local media landscape. Morris Communications announced Wednesday it has signed an agreement to sell the assets of Morris Publishing Group, including the Florida Times Union and the St. Augustine Record, to a firm called Gatehouse Media. Now, Gatehouse is a division of the New Media Investment Group, a publicly traded company on the New York Stock Exchange. It's one of the largest newspaper companies in the country, owning more than 130 daily papers and more than 500 non-daily publications and websites across the United States. With this purchase, Gatehouse becomes the largest newspaper owner in Florida. It already owns a number of publications around the Sunshine State. So what might this sale mean for both the newspapers in our area and the community? Here with his thoughts, we're pleased to welcome from St. Petersburg, Florida, Rick Edmonds. He's a media business analyst for the Poynter Institute, a global leader and resource for journalists. Rick, thanks for being with us.
Good to be with you, Melissa.
And also on the line, former Times Union editor and WJCT business analyst, John Burr. John, thanks for joining the show.
Good to be here.
And here's our question to callers. As news breaks that our local newspapers have been sold to a new owner, what are your thoughts about what this means for news coverage here on the First Coast? Give us a call, 549-2937. That's 549-2937. Or go online, send your emails to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org, tweets to @MelissaInJax. Or you can weigh in on our Facebook page. Rick Edmonds, let's begin with you. And let me disclose first off that my husband's a longtime employee of the Times Union. Just need to make note of that.
Okay.
What are your initial thoughts about this purchase?
Well, a lot of these things take me by surprise when I read them, but they tend to make sense afterwards. And there's really a kind of powerful trend of consolidation moving through the industry right now. So individually owned papers and smaller chains are frequently deciding that this is a good time to sell and sort of hand it over to a larger chain that has economies of scale and can sort of take the paper successfully as a business through the next several years.
And how has Gatehouse done that with other papers around the country? What's their model?
Well, they have a combination of things. They do things efficiently. They've been running papers for a long time, and they've grown quite a lot. They do many things in a centralized way, and that's the biggest source of savings. And they would have their own advertising systems. They actually do the layout and copy editing for all of their papers in the center in Austin, Texas. They don't even have a paper in Austin. That's just where the center is. So, you know, they're kind of a big footprint, and it's a mix. I would say their papers tend to be not really heavily staffed locally, but they do some outstanding work. And in fact, the Sarasota paper, you might say, is their top paper, and recently won a Pulitzer and has done a lot of distinguished things. So, you know, I may foresee some cooperative Florida investigations ahead. So that would be a net plus. And I would guess they would leave. Let me put it this way: they may or may not leave current editors and managers in place, but my sense is that that's some way down the road, that at least for right now, there won't be radical changes in how the paper reports.
John Burr, our business editor, of course, you were an editor at the Times Union for many years. Gatehouse Media now becomes the largest daily newspaper owner in Florida. It had bought up other publications and led to unionization in other cities. The Sarasota Herald Tribune and the Lakeland Ledger unionized their newsrooms after Gatehouse bought them. The first daily papers in Florida to do that.
Yeah, that's right. That happened last year. And, you know, that was largely in reaction to staff cuts at both of those papers, and also a feeling that among the newsroom people that they needed the protection of a union. And really, it's that's very historic for a paper and two papers actually owned by the same company in Florida to unionize their newsroom. That's the first time that's ever happened.
And did the union move provide protection to some of the employees that were worried about losing their jobs?
Well, you know, it's still too early to say, but you know, certainly the employees felt like that would be what they would get, was some protection against that. But you know, we'll just have to see how that plays out.
Right, and Rick Edmonds, you know, you track journalism around the world, and we've heard so much about the decimation of the newspaper business. This transaction, though, shows that obviously some companies still see value in newspapers, right?
Well, I think that's right, and we have a sort of separate movement in the United States of a lot of very wealthy people investing in newspapers. Sometimes it's with a hope of making money. Sometimes it's just to be in the business and keep papers alive in their home communities and elsewhere. Jeff Bezos with the Washington Post is maybe the biggest example. But yeah, I mean, this is this firm is backed by a large investment fund, Fortress Capital, and you know, clearly they do think there's some money to be made. I would say, from a business perspective, I think they're. Horizon is fairly short term, over the next 4 or 5 years. So after that, who knows for sure?
And we'll go to your
John's point is well taken, that they did cut staff so severely at the Lakeland and Sarasota papers, both of which were formerly owned by the New York Times Company, that the remaining staff there took the unusual step of unionizing.
And to our callers, what do you think about the big media news this week as Morse Communications announced yesterday it's selling its newspaper operations to Gatehouse Media, new ownership for both the Florida Times Union and the St. Augustine Record? What are your thoughts about our newspaper coverage in this area and what this might mean? We'll go to your calls in a moment at 549-2937. John Burr, quick question for you. How much more staff can a company like Gatehouse cut from the Florida Times Union? It has seen round after round of layoffs. Its staff is a fraction of what used to be in that building. Of course, we're hearing that that building is going to be sold and the staff will probably soon be setting up new digs somewhere else. But how many more cuts can they make and still put out a paper?
Probably not many. You know, the Times Union and all of Morris, really, they've been run on a shoestring for a long, long time. Morris is really well known in the industry as a very frugal company. They've always kept costs to a minimum. In the newsroom, that's meant, you know, smaller staff and subpar pay. All that to say that Gatehouse might not find much to cut once they really start looking in there. And I think they're aware of that. And that probably made the purchase of the Morris properties all that more attractive to them.
Let me ask you as well, Rick, from you're a media business analyst. This company, Gatehouse Media, actually reorganized, filed for bankruptcy back in 2013. What's
Correct.
Its financial picture today?
Well, it's a little bit unclear because of the sort of major backing of a big private equity company. Its stock has done reasonably well. It's unusual among newspapers in that it pays a fairly generous dividend. So, you know, you can make more money owning their stock on a dividend basis. Of course, it depends whether it goes up or down than putting it in the bank or anywhere. So you know, there are some good things going for this company. And I think, to John's point, yes, cuts in staff may make some more, would be my guess. But a big part of it will be to import their systems, for instance, content management systems of the digital version of the paper, how you see it on a smartphone and all that kind of thing is tremendously complicated. And a little company like Morris can't do that very well by itself, stay up to date. A big company like Gatehouse can.
Mm-hmm. And you know what?
And I would also raise the question, which is not a question for today or tomorrow, but maybe 5 years from now, is that we may see companies moving to either Sunday-only print publication or even a fully digital publication.
Yeah, that was my next question to you. Like, what's the event horizon, I guess, for people no longer getting a print paper on their doorstep anymore?
That's debatable, but my view is that we're a couple years away from seeing that on a widespread basis. Some companies with their smallest papers have gone to 3 times a week, and I think there would be the intermediate step of keeping the Sunday paper, which really generates more than half the advertising revenue and, you know, it's popular with readers. So that would be kept even if the some of the daily print editions disappeared.
It really is the end of an era.
Five, ten years. Got to worry about that.
John Burr, it's the end of the old analog print era in many ways for news media. I mean, it's been this long rolling process we've watched unfold. But I think Rick's right. It's hastening now.
Yeah, it is. And, you know, really that era that you're talking about, probably ended around 2000. You know, if to Rick's point, if they go to a Sunday-only circulation, of course, that means the news staff can be, you know, really cut and save money. You know, their circulation is really, it's just awful right now. They're at 45,000 circulation daily, 69,000 on Sunday for the Times Union. They were at, you know, in the early 90s, they were at 200,000 circulation daily. So their circulation is less than 25% of what it was at the height. That kind of gives you an indication of where their revenue is and where their staffing is.
And let me ask this question to callers. How do you read the Florida Times Union? Do you look at it online? Do you take the daily paper or not? If not, why not? Give us a call with your thoughts about this sale at 549-2937. And here's a tweet from Phyllis. She tweets the show, as a loyal advertiser for many years, the sale of the Times Union obviously raises concerns. I'm anxious to know what, if any, changes will be coming. Damon tweets us, great news for the employees. Morris was notorious for their miserly payment scheme, he writes. Here's another tweet. Have they announced what will happen with the numerous Slick magazines also produced by the TU, First Coast Magazine, Jack, etc.? Do we know the answer to that yet, Rick? We don't.
I don't know the answer to that, and I'm not even really sure that the buyers have that all mapped out. And Melissa, I'm very sorry. I have a teaching obligation at 9:20, so I'm going to have to ring off. But I hope your readers continue to converse about it.
Thank you so much, Rick Edmonds, analyst with Pointer, on the line with us from St. Petersburg. Thanks for jumping onto the show. And let's take a few calls right now from listeners. It's 549-2937. What are your thoughts about the big sale of the Times Union and the St. Augustine Record? Conrad is in Arlington. Hey, Conrad, good morning.
Good morning. Northside this morning with us. Okay, I'm all around town. I'm a longtime subscriber, multi-generation subscriber. I remember when our local paper, true local paper, the Journal, was benevolently taken in by a larger Times Union when the Journal was about to just go out of business. And so we've had the B section, then we've had the remnants of local news that are down to a trickle now. We have B section, mostly Georgia news, St. John's County news, Clay County, whatever. And half of what I get is full pages of advertising and stuff, which after a while, you can't help but realize how much advertising you're getting with no print media to go with it. But I sent an email that there was a CC line to you, I believe, that I put in a couple of weeks ago with a fact check question that I had at the Times Union when they printed the article on the Detroit riots. It came down to wire services, which I am not one who slams the wire services. I think they've been around a long time. I hope they try to maintain their reputation. But this article came out of Detroit with non-factual material and a paragraph in there, and I sent it to, among other people, Mike Clark, whom I've dealt with.
Okay, but Conrad, could you talk a little? I understand what your point, but we really want to talk more about the bigger picture here.
Okay. Well, I mean, I just have not gotten anything other than a brief note from Mary Kay Palka that it was going to be looked into. They've done nothing about correcting the error that was, blatant. But this is something we've lived with for years, and I just had to put in my 2 cents.
I gotcha. Okay. And I hear what he's saying. Thanks, Conrad. As newspaper staffs get smaller and smaller, John, issues like that get more challenging if you only have so many people to catch errors and respond to customers and so forth.
Oh, yeah. And this has been playing out across the country at papers for, 15 or 20 years now. It's, you have to realize that the whole industry has gone through wave after wave of layoffs and staff reductions. Most, in fact, with the exception maybe of the New York Times and the Wall Street Journal and maybe the Washington Post, all papers have really been hollowed out by the digital, the lack of advertising in the digital age, and also
And let me just jump in and say, what does that mean for local communities when you lose or you see greatly shrunk the newspaper that documents the community? That to me is a big loss. It's a cultural catastrophe, I think, in many ways.
It is a big loss, and that your question is a huge question, and it has to do with maintaining democracy in the country and an informed public and everything else. We're going to find out. I mean, because this has happened and it's happened everywhere. We're going to find out in the next few years, just without that watchdog function of the local press, looking over what's going on in cities around the country, what's going to be the outcome of that?
All right, let's go now to a few more calls. Don is on the south side. Hi, Don. Good morning.
Good morning. Oh, this saddens me very much. I'm 67, and during the 50s and 60s, we had three papers daily. Two of them were morning and evening editions, the Boston Globe and I forgot the other one. But anyway, there were always papers around to read, and a lot of it was local, and we got a lot of our information. I mean, just incidentally, from a civics standpoint, to lose, I love reading Ron Little page locally. I mean, I'm just so scared we're going to lose it entirely. That's my comment. And I'm somewhat of a Luddite, so the computer thing doesn't turn me on. I love that. I just love the texture and the smell of a newspaper.
Yeah, I know what you're saying.
Thank you for this, Melissa.
Thank you, Don. Okay, Cynthia in Lakeshore. Go ahead, Cynthia.
I, too, am a Luddite. I can remember hearing my mother, who has been deceased for 8 years now at the age of 90, almost 96, exclaim as she was reading Pope McHenry's old column, "Oh, Pope is quoting my column from when I wrote Ramblings from the Beaches." She had written a column for the Times Union when she was about 16 and 17 and 18.
Oh, nice.
But I think that Morris has done a wonderful job. It has been so important that they be frugal through this recessionary period. Not only do we have the transition to a new way of communicating, but it does cost money to produce a paper, and as it does to run any business. And I really appreciate the fact that they have kept our Florida Times Union alive.
Right,
something
yeah.
It could be sold. And I hope that some of the, like Frank Denton and some of the editors that we really appreciate and enjoy reading will still be retained in the paper.
Thanks, Cynthia.
The
yeah.
Local news will be.
We'll continue, right, right.
I hope that it'll reduce the amount that is charged for subscriptions, because I think the subscribers would be greater if their subscription rates were less.
Okay, thanks for that. Megan in St. Augustine, go ahead, Megan, you're on the air.
Thank you. Melissa, I think while I was on hold, some people covered what I was so concerned about and why I called in, which is I'm not so concerned about whether or not there's print media or online media. It's that I feel like people are not keeping up with the news. I don't know where they get their news. I don't know where they get their facts. And I feel like it's like the caller before me said, it's a degradation of our, you know, three branches of government and the way that we run.
Yeah, and if they hear news they disagree with, they say it's fake.
I wondered if anyone was ever going to do a survey. That's fine that newspapers are going out of business, I guess, but then where are people getting their news? What do they believe? What do they not believe? And what percentage of our population at some point is just not getting any news at all?
Right.
Or not listening to anything, or just listening to these opinion radios. Or, you know, I just don't feel like it's just a newspaper issue. I really feel like it's just more where are the facts, where are the reporters, you know, where are people getting what's really important?
Sure. And in recent years, there have been a number of really well-produced investigative series in the Florida Times Union by some very good people that have improved this community. Megan, thanks for that call. Doran on the west side. Go ahead, Doran.
Good morning, Melissa. I have a question for you. I'm wondering how you think, and your guests, how you think the editorial position of the Times Union will change under the new ownership.
Sure. Thanks for that. We're getting emails about that, too. John Burr, Morris Communications, of course, one of the only, the Times Union, I think the only paper in America other than the paper in Las Vegas, which is owned by a casino magnate named Sheldon Adelson. The only paper in America to endorse Donald Trump last time. Do you think this new ownership will change the editorial slant of the TU's op-ed page?
That's a good question. I don't think so. That endorsement of Trump was something that was mandated from the corporate headquarters in Augusta. And that was really the first time that Augusta had ever done that, really mandated an editorial like that or endorsement like that. So I don't think that in itself is indicative of the Times Union editorial policy, and I don't think Gatehouse is going to come in and change that very much. You know, Gatehouse, you know, they've got to come in and assess the business operation and very quickly and try to make whatever adjustments they see. What's going on the editorial page, that's probably about 7 or 8 on their to-do list.
Right. Well, we'll continue to follow it, and lots of folks waiting on hold to weigh in on this. Sorry we can't get to all of you. It is big news as the Times Union, the St. Augustine Record, and other papers are sold to Gatehouse Media. We'll continue to follow the impact of this. John Burr, our business analyst and former Times Union editor, thanks for being with us.
Good to be here.
Much more still ahead. Later, Jacksonville-based APR Energy is bringing relief to Australia as that nation struggles with power blackouts. We'll tell you about it. But up next, should the nation's air traffic controllers be privatized? We'll hear from one group that says no. Back in a moment.
Goodwill of North Florida. Donate, shop, jobs. Good things from North Florida with Goodwill. Proud supporters of WJCT's First Coast Connect. GoodwillJax.org for more info.
The state of Michigan is being sued because the schools in Detroit have been failing its kids.
We had teachers who didn't really understand the subject, so we weren't learning anything throughout the whole school year.
I'm Kai Rizdahl, the economics of education, reading, writing, arithmetic, and poverty. Next time on Marketplace.
Weekday evenings at 6 on 89.9 WJCT. Your community, your world.
On the next Jazz Night in America, a look into the music of Rahsaan Roland Kirk.
People were drawn to Rahsaan. They could feel that he was given not 100%, but 2,000%.
Steve Touré leads the band, Bright Moments. That's on the next Jazz Night in America.
Saturdays at 8 p.m. and Thursdays at 11 p.m. on 89.9 WJCT. Your community, your world.
If a hurricane threatens our state, Florida's public radio stations have joined forces to ensure you receive important storm information. No matter where you are, you can stay informed on the radio, online, on social media, and on the mobile app Florida Storms. Timely weather information is always available from WJCT. The Florida Public Radio Emergency Network is supported by Citizens Property Insurance. Online at citizensfla.com.
Welcome back. Well, back in the first week of August in 1981, do you remember this? President Ronald Reagan fired more than 11,000 air traffic controllers who had ignored his order to return to work. It was a sweeping mass firing of federal employees, and it slowed down commercial air travel. Fast forward now to 2017. A bill moving through Capitol Hill seeks to privatize the nation's air traffic controllers. But House leadership and the White House have so far failed to bring together the votes needed to pass H.R. 2997. It's the House version of an FAA reauthorization package that would privatize America's air traffic control system. Why is this being pushed by the White House, and what would it mean? Selena Shalad is executive director of the Alliance for Aviation Across America, an advocacy group opposed to privatization, and she's on the line from Washington. Selena, thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
So this bill would essentially privatize the nation's air traffic control system. Why? What would this accomplish, and how would this change the way we travel?
Sure. So, you know, basically what's being proposed, as you said, is to take our current air traffic control system that's overseen by the FAA and Congress and put it under the purview of, you know, an 11 or so person board that would oversee, you know, all aspects of our air traffic control system, whether it's hiring controllers, where resources are spent, how they're allocated, you know, lots of different decisions that could impact many different facets of our air traffic control system. And I think, you know, our concern is multifold. Number one, you know, our air traffic control system right now is a public system, which means it's overseen by members of Congress and the FAA. So, you know, there are 5,000 airports around the country. About 3,200 of those are eligible for federal funding. And the commercial airlines use about predominantly use about 30 of those airports. So that's just a lot of airports and areas of the country that, you know, under a privatized system where you have control overseen by the biggest commercial operators and private interests, there's no real incentive to ensure that, you know, we retain access for all types, sizes of communities throughout our nation. And that's important not only economically, because there's a lot of businesses that depend on smaller airports and general aviation, but it's important in terms of critical services and medical care and blood transport and medevac and firefighting and lots of other services that our communities depend on, you know, as a result of knowing that kind of our air traffic control system is part of our national public infrastructure.
Okay. On the other hand, the airlines and the White House are supporting this, saying that it would end wasteful spending, inefficiencies, This is a top priority for the major air carriers. What about their argument that this would improve operations?
Well, I guess what I would say is how. You know, I think that's perhaps why this idea hasn't kind of come to fruition in terms of garnering enough support to pass out of Congress. And I should note, it's really been decades that the commercial airlines have been pushing for privatization and have been saying, you know, we can run this better. But, you know, if you look at the top causes of the delays, the Department of Transportation tracks that, and consistently across the board, it's factors within the airline's control that are the top causes of delays. And then, you know, you have a lot of issues with the airline's own management of their own reservations and technology systems, for example. So I think if you're going to make the case that you can run it better, you have to say how and why and, you know, what savings would be achieved and what efficiencies would be achieved. But unfortunately, right now, we just kind of hear these broad sound bites, but no real specifics in terms of how the system would be made more efficient if you put the airlines in control.
Now, your organization just the other day got a celebrity endorsement, retired Captain Chesley Sully Sullenberger, the famous pilot who made that miraculous emergency landing in the Hudson River in 2009, U.S. Air pilot. He is coming out against this proposal, saying that the FAA system should not be handed over to a private company. I'm quoting, "Why should we give such an important, valuable national asset to the largest airlines who often put expedience and cost reduction ahead of the safety and welfare of others?" That's a pretty strong accusation. One you agree with?
It is. I would. I mean, I think that if you look at the track record, you know, the airlines, the commercial airlines are currently making record profits, but consumers, you know, are seeing smaller seats. They're seeing more fees. I think it was $7.9 billion or so last year of new fees that are kind of being decimated by customers for everything from baggage to change fees. And, you know, those are fees that are increasing because the airlines don't have to pay taxes on them. So I think what you see is, I mean, it's natural, right, that the commercial airlines are a private industry. They want to put their own private bottom line first. And, you know, I think what we have found is when it comes to things like air traffic control and national defense, those are things that, you know, we should make decisions about funding and how we spend money and how we allocate resources based on safety and our security and what's in the public's interest and not any one particular industry's bottom line.
And the House is considering this. The president supports it. What's the status of the legislation? Is it likely to make it through the process or not?
Hard to say. You know, we've seen the airlines push for this legislation for so many years. I think you know, with the president voicing some support, I think they see a real window of opportunity, and they're pushing extremely hard to try and get this through Congress. But you know, a lot of concerns remain. You know, particularly about some of the concerns that we've outlined. So, you know, it's tough to forecast whatever Congress or the government will do. But I think that, you know, there's definitely still a bit of an uphill battle because there's just a variety of different concerns, you know, whether it's security or consumer concerns or rural access that kind of haven't really been answered or alleviated. And as I said, I don't think really the business case has been made as to how privatization would really increase competition or save money.
Well, thanks for sharing your thoughts. We'll follow it. She's Selena Shalad, Executive Director of the Alliance for Aviation Across America. Thanks for joining the show.
Thanks for having me.
We'll be right back.
On the next Fresh Air, the still unfolding story of the Kennedy assassination. Investigative reporter Philip Sheenan tells us about the newly declassified documents which shed light on Lee Harvey Oswald's trip to Mexico weeks before the assassination. He met with Cuban officials and may have boasted about planning to kill the American president. Join us. Weekdays at noon on 89.9 WJCT. Your community, your world.
David Clark is the African-American Democratic sheriff in Milwaukee County. He's also 100% behind President Trump on immigration.
Well, I don't know how any law enforcement official can sit back with a straight face and say our communities are stronger because of illegal immigration.
Now, Clark says we need to do away with sanctuary cities.
These things are killing communities. They're killing cities.
On the next Reveal.
Thursday at 1 on 89.9 WJCT.
Calling all educators. WJCT and Community First Credit Union are proud to present the 5th Annual Teach Conference, an event created by teachers to engage, empower, and inspire. Saturday, September 16th at the Hyatt Regency Hotel. Tickets are $30. Tickets purchased for the 2016 event will be honored. Share ideas with colleagues. Learn new ways to engage students and empower yourself to inspire others. Bring a friend and get your tickets now. WJCT.org/teach.
Welcome back. Well, the Jacksonville-based firm APR Energy has signed a contract to provide portable power to an area of Australia that's been suffering some bad blackouts. APR Energy specializes in prefabricated power plants. They get remote areas up and running on an electrical grid until permanent juice can be established. With this big news, APR Energy has joined world leaders, including Tesla CEO Elon Musk, who are trying to offer solutions to South Australia in an effort to stem the blackouts. APR Energy CEO John Campion is on the line with more. Hey, John.
Good morning. How are you?
Good, thanks. Thanks for being with us. A big contract for your Jacksonville-based firm. First off, let me ask you, why is Australia in the midst of blackouts?
It's a sort of a... How would you put it? It's the result of the result of unintended consequences. That
okay,
was the word I was looking to put together. So Southern Australia is very dependent on both solar and wind, and as a lot of economies around the world are going to renewable energy, and there's obviously a big push for it. But what ends up happening is as you bring the renewables on, you tend to take some of the older type of machinery offline, especially fossil fuel, coal, natural gas, the like of that. You tend to take that offline. And you tend to become more and more dependent on the renewables. Now, as you can probably imagine, when you're sitting on your back porch at night, the sun doesn't switch off. It sort of goes down. And when the wind stops, it doesn't stop. It sort of tapers off. So when you get these things happening, they start putting large stress on the grid by spiking. So in other words, as the sun's going down, it's brighter, then it's suddenly dimmer, then it's brighter again. And you end up in a situation where you've got stress on the grid. And sometimes if you don't have enough spinning reserve, as in fossil fuel machinery to fire up and sort of push that grid back up and balance it out, you end up in blackouts.
Wow. And how does this, and how is what you're seeing in Australia reflecting trends in the energy sector more broadly all around the world as we phase out the older fuels?
Right. So what ends up happening, and where Tesla and Elon Musk are doing, they're putting a big battery system on. And so if you will, you've got the grid feeding into the battery, then feeding back out to the grid. So that will take up a certain amount of slack as the power fluctuates with the sun going down and the wind stops blowing, correct?
Mm-hmm.
It's a bit like a big battery. But that battery only lasts so long. So he's supplying them roughly a 15-minute battery. So the contract we signed was to bring a couple of hundred megawatt online within that 15-minute period. So a combination of his batteries and our turbines solves the issue.
So tell me a little bit more then about how APR Energy is adapting to these trends. And by the way, you are based here in Jacksonville. People may not realize this global energy firm is right here on the First Coast.
Yes, we are. We've been in Jacksonville for, the business actually started in Jacksonville, so we've been in Jacksonville for a very long time. What's happening? Our business historically was a business that supplied interim power, whether it was a hydro shortage in an emerging market, a hydro shortage in the developed market, or a situation where there was the tsunami in Japan at Fukushima. There was a huge power problem there, so we supplied a couple hundred megawatts within 45 days after the earthquake into Fukushima. So there was a lot of our business was event driven, if you will. Our emerging markets, their economy was growing. There's a lot of urbanization. In other words, people moving from rural areas into cities. Demand for electricity was going up. They weren't able to invest and bring new power stations online. So we'd go in there as an interim solution. We did a lot of that in Africa. But the business is changing, and it's a very, very interesting time to be in the energy sector because you've got a lot of different things happening. You've got a lot of renewables, and we just talked about the results of the unintended consequences. We just discussed that. So you have a lot of that happening. You've got a lot of cheap gas where power is coming online and it's a lot cheaper. So coal is going offline. Natural gas, which is a lot cleaner, is coming online. And a lot of the problems of the intermittent grid and grid stability issues are happening in first world countries. Portugal is beginning to experience that. France and Germany are beginning to experience that, and we're beginning to see, a lot of, globally different things happening which didn't exist, 5-10 years ago. So it's a great time to be in the business I'm in, and I think it's certainly exciting. And when you're in a business and you're talking to a customer in Southern Australia and you're talking about what you can do to help solve the problem, and you're sitting at the table and effectively you're supplying power in conjunction with Elon Musk and Tesla, that's pretty interesting stuff.
Sure. And with our changing climate and changing energy needs, what's your long-term play for your company as you respond to all of these trends?
Well, look, we want to be on the cutting edge of what's happening. We want to be looking at the various ways that we can benefit our customers, bring power on faster. Let me sort of explain it to you this way. This is going to happen. We see this beginning to happen in America. If you're a utility that's heavily dependent on renewables and say FPNL down south of Florida, you then go to market and contract reserve capacity from individual companies. So if we can't make electricity, we'll pay you to bring it on. And the difference for the first 5 to 10 minutes is a huge amount of money. In other words, if you call me up and say, John, turn on your power plant, that's going to take 5 to 10 to 15 minutes. But if I can give you power instantaneously, you're going to pay me effectively a rate 24/7 for that. So that's putting energy storage and fast operating turbines in the same sort of package and being able to have what you would call spinning reserve, but without having anything running.
This is fascinating stuff. I hope you'll come back sometime and talk some more about it. And by the way, it's interesting to know your full story. You started out as a roadie for rock stars like David Bowie, and you supplied all the juice for these rock arena concerts, and that's how you went into the energy field. It's a cool story about you, John Campion.
Not a bother. Well, I'll tell you some next time. I'll tell you the story how I ended up in Jacksonville thanks to the Rolling Stones. But there you have it.
Oh, and we're out of time. Oh, yeah. You'll
not a bother.
You'll have to come back for that one. He's CEO of APR Energy, John Campion. Thanks for joining us.
All right. Bye-bye. God bless.
All righty. We'll be right back.
Hi, Chris Thiele here, and what a show we have for you this weekend on A Prairie Home Companion, if I do say so myself. Andrew Bird is in the house, as well as Miss Laura Marling, and the hilarious comedian Beth Stelling. Plus, the Royal Academy of Radio Actors will be there, our first call radio players, and a song of the week called We Joe Madden. All this and much more. I hope you'll join us.
Saturday evenings at 6 on 89.9 WJCT.
Summertime is learning time. WJCT and the Jacksonville Public Library are partnering to help families fight this summer slide with educational programming and online resources that encourage learning at home. Log on to wjct.org/education/summer to find summer reading lists, activity books, early literacy development tools, and much more. Help your child prepare for the new school year at wjct.org/education/summer.
Welcome back. Finally, this hour, a compelling story of international adoption. When Annie and Peter decide to adopt, they set their sights on a child from Africa. But this opens up a well of uncertainty that speaks to their identity as white Americans. That's the setting for the play The Call. It's a portrait of cultural divide, casting global issues into the heart of an American home. This show takes the stage at Jacksonville's Five and Dime Theater this weekend. Founder Lee Hamby is here. Good morning.
Good morning, Melissa.
Along with star of the show, Aaron Salem. Good to see you.
Thank you.
What's The Call mean? What is that, a phone call?
It's or? Like when you're going through the process of adoption, you finally get that call that they've matched you with. They found your child. So it's a big deal.
Yeah. And so in this show, the couple, Annie and Peter, they get the call.
They get the call. To take you on a without telling you too much, they are trying to have a child and they're having issues. They've gone through IVF, they've done all these things and they then decide on adoption. So they think about where they're going to adopt from. Are they going to adopt locally? Are they going to adopt from China? Are they going to adopt from Africa? And then they make a comment about how it's a fashion statement to adopt from Africa because, you know, people like Angelina Jolie
has done it.
Yes. So right. It does bring up lots of really interesting topics.
Okay. So, Aaron, you play the wife, Annie, in this.
Yes.
So you and your husband decide we're going to adopt an African baby. And then what happens after that?
It's pretty intense. There are some other characters in the show who really take us on the journey of considering what this means. Learning about somebody else's culture is not as easy as YouTubing it. Mm-hmm. And so as they make this decision, they really have to take into consideration just whether or not this is right for the child, let alone them, and how much they have to learn and what it does to their relationship as they talk through these issues is pretty intense.
Hmm. And is this based on stories of real couples that have gone through this?
The playwright, Tanya Barfield, actually went through the process. It's interesting that she chose not to write about herself. She's actually biracial and she adopted an African child. So she wanted, I guess, for the stage and more drama, she wanted to tell the story through a white couple to show such a big difference between and what really could happen and what could affect the child and what could affect them. So it's just a really interesting way to talk about a subject that I know myself, people don't talk about it a lot. I am adopted, but it was something that was kind of taboo and you never talked about it.
Huh.
Yeah.
Now, in the description for the show, it says that the adoption causes an identity crisis for this couple as white people. Mm-hmm. So is the couple forced to confront their own racism in this whole process?
I don't know that it's racism. I think it is a little bit of ignorance, only because they don't live that life. They don't experience those things. They actually use the subject of hair a lot in this show to talk about the fact that they don't understand what it's like to have to think about, I can't get my hair wet. Or when am I going to get my hair done? Or what products am I going to use? And so as they experience those conversations with their friends who are African American, they finally get the sense that there may be more about this we didn't think about or we didn't think to think about because we don't live it.
Now, without giving away the ending, does the baby make its way to the family?
It does not.
Oh.
It may? Am I right, Aaron?
That's right.
It may. So it leaves you wondering. Yes.
How it all comes together.
Which I love an ending like that because you kind of can make your own assumptions.
Now, this show starts this weekend at Downtown Five and Dime, correct?
Tomorrow night.
Tell us a little bit more about the Downtown Theater space.
We are so happy to have our new space. our permanent space. It allows us to have people find us a lot easier than when we were nomadic. It is a lot easier to set up shop and build sets, and we don't have to carry everything around. And it's just, it's been a wonderful thing since January.
Well, go to the5anddime.org. That's the number 5anddime.org. Get your tickets now for The Call. Star Aaron Salem and director Lee Hamby. Have fun. Break a leg. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having
Thank
us.
Thank you.
That's our show. Thanks to all of our guests and callers. Our producer is Kevin Merschart. Michelle Corum runs the board. The show theme is composed and performed by the Jacksonville Symphony's Pyotr Chevchik. And never miss a show. Download the WJCT app. Listen there anytime. Next on 1A, how Guam is handling North Korea's threats. I'm Melissa Ross, and this has been First Coast Connect on 89.9 WJCT-FM Jacksonville, your community, your world. We'll be right back here again at 9 a.m. tomorrow for our Friday roundtable. Have a great day.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.